West and on the East Coast, Clark had emulated the lighter swinging style of Joe Jones, shifting the underlying beat from the bass drum to the ride cymbal. On top of this, Clark added an array of offbeat accents, percussive asides, and cracking cat-o'-nine-tails interjections designed to propel the soloist. These polyrhythmic explosions came to be called bombs by the jazz players of the war years. Clark's nickname, Kluk, sometimes Klukmop, may have been an onomatopoetic echo of this technique. He would come to play a prominent role at the Harlem Jam Sessions where the new modern jazz style was forged. Proficient on several instruments and a skilled composer, he is listed as co-writer of Gillespie's Salt Peanuts and Monk's Epistrophe. Clark stood out as one of the most versatile percussionists of his generation. Gillespie's next major employer, Cab Calloway, was more than a top jazz bandleader, but also one of the leading entertainers of his day. His flamboyant wardrobe, his extroverted stage presence, his pseudo-hip scat singing captured the public's imagination, so much so that George Gershwin used him as the model for the flashy Sportin' Life character in Porgy and Bess. Calloway and Gillespie had a stormy relationship. The trumpeter was eventually fired after a heated offstage encounter with the bandleader. But Dizzy clearly learned by watching his boss's act. Playing with Cab, I was always doing my damnedest to be hip, Gillespie later acknowledged. Following his stint with the band, Gillespie began sporting the beret and stylish clothes that would become virtual trademarks of the bebop movement. Gillespie would later stand out as the only prominent member of the bebop generation who took the role of entertainer seriously, and he made it a point to charm the audiences who came to see him with his banter, as well as with his music. Whether in pursuing hokey on-stage routines or simply ad-libbing jokes with the audience, he countered and at times even parodied the self-serious attitude of his contemporaries. Calloway's influence in this regard has typically been ignored by commentators and critics, but may well have been decisive. Of course, Gillespie's evolution during this period went beyond the superficial veneer of clothing and mannerisms. Section mate Mario Bassa, who had befriended Gillespie during his early New York days, again took the younger trumpeter under his wing. Mario was like my father, as well as nurturing Gillespie's growing interest in Afro-Cuban music. Gillespie's arrangement of Pickin' the Cabbage for the Calloway Band reflected this new direction in his compositions. His opportunities outside of the Calloway Band also began to expand. In 1939, Gillespie was enlisted to participate in the Lionel Hampton recording of When Lights Are Low and Hot Mallets, where he worked alongside a horn section composed of Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, Benny Carter, and Chu Berry. Less visible to the public, but even more influential, were the informal sessions Gillespie was attending when the Calloway Band resided in New York. These jam sessions at Minton's and Moreau's Uptown House have frequently been cited as the birthplace of bop, the melting pot where the disparate elements that contributed to this music coalesced into a definable style. First-hand accounts, supplemented by a few amateur recordings, reinforce the importance of these venues. Yet their elevation to mythic status has overshadowed the many innovations that were making headway outside their doors, and glosses over the halting and gradual progress that often took place even on these famous bandstands, where more traditional instrumentalists, vocalists of various stripes, and assorted wannabes often shared the stage with the burgeoning boppers. To a great extent, the historical importance of the Minton's and Monroe's sessions only became clear in retrospect. I wasn't thinking about trying to change the course of jazz, I was just trying to play something that sounded good, Thelonious Monk later characterized the Minton's gig. Monk and Kenny Clarke were the only prominent modernists on the payroll at the club, but the guests on any given night might include other young progressives such as Gillespie or Parker, Jimmy Blanton or Charlie Christian, as well as seasoned swing-era veterans Roy Eldridge, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Benny Goodman, or Ben Webster. Of the younger players involved in the Minton sessions, pianist Thelonious Monk stood out as one of the most adventurous and clearly the least easy to classify. His interest in unconventional harmonies and rhythmic patterns converged to some extent with Gillespie and Parker's, but his overall conception of improvisation and composition remained sui generis. As his mature style made clear, the facile virtuosity of other beboppers held little lasting interest for him, nor was he attracted to the fast tempos and flashy improvisational style that came to characterize most bebop music. Instead, he delved more deeply into textures and dissonances, and pursued a style of improvisation far more compositional in nature. Few other pianists were prepared to follow in this path until the 1950s, and the full extent of his impact would not be felt until after his death in 1982. Only a few days younger than Gillespie, Monk had been born in Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, on October 10, 1917, but spent most of his youth in the San Juan Hills section of New York. His family's acquisition of a player piano sometime around 1926 inspired the youngster to try his hand at the keyboard, and he began taking lessons at age 11. In his teens, Monk apprenticed in the musical venues of Harlem, which ranged from rent parties to the Apollo Theater, and at 16 he went on the road with an evangelical troupe. He was a little-known musician, scuffling from gig to gig when, at age 23, he landed the job as house pianist at Minton's. Monk and the other Minton's players were soon joined by an alto saxophonist who was making a name for himself at after-hour sessions held at nearby Clark Monroe's Uptown House. Charlie Parker, who had crossed paths with Gillespie in Kansas City some months back, was now frequently reunited with a trumpeter on stage at these New York sessions. Now supported by Clark, Monk, and other talented young players, Parker and Gillespie solidified their experimental leanings into a powerful style. They began recrafting standard songs such as I Got Rhythm, as well as developing new compositions, pursuing faster and faster tempos, and honing a quicksilver virtuoso technique that would frighten and astonish, by turns, other instrumentalists. A paper disc recording from the collection of Jerry Newman finds Parker, circa 1942, blowing over the changes of Cherokee at a Monroe session. Bird's rhythm section is stodgy, offering a tepid two-beat support, but Parker's solo is fiery and inventive. Another amateur recording of Sweet Georgia Brown from a few months later finds Parker in more suitable company, with Gillespie joining him on trumpet, the duo's earliest surviving recorded collaboration, and Blanton disciple Oscar Pettiford, a sympathetic accompanist, on bass. This is a raw performance, especially Gillespie's contribution, but there can be no mistaking it for anything other than bebop. By this time, both Parker and Gillespie were working together in Earl Hines's big band. Despite his prominence as a master of traditional styles, Hines had put together what may well have been the most forward-looking jazz orchestra of its day. From 1928 to 1939, Hines had found a safe haven from the Great Depression, which decimated the careers of so many musicians, as leader of the house band at the Grand Terrace, a posh Chicago nightclub. Hines was almost the antithesis of Ellington, preferring to delegate responsibility for his band's sound rather than take an active role as leader. He prospered by hiring musical talents with different stylistic allegiances from his own and giving them substantial responsibility for shaping the style of the group. This would prove to be a key formula for the 1943 band's success. But even a decade earlier, Hines had moved far beyond the classic sound of his sides with Louis Armstrong and Jimmy Noon, although he would return to this traditional approach after the 20-year hiatus that spanned from 1928 to 1948, and was anticipating the advent of the swing era. Relying on the strong charts of Jimmy Mundy, Bud Johnson, Quinn Wilson, and others, Hines was fronting one of the hottest dance bands of the day. But almost at the crest of the swing era, Hines was already embracing even more modern sounds. The first signs of the Hines band's flirtation with bebop could be seen in 1941, when members Billy Eckstine, Bud Johnson, Freddie Webster, Little Benny Harris, and Shadow Wilson all showed, to a greater or lesser extent, leanings toward a more progressive conception of jazz. These allegiances exploded into full-fledged modernism late in 1942 when Hines hired Gillespie, whose reputation had spread through his work with Calloway, Lucky Millinder, and others. A short while later, Hines brought in Charlie Parker to play tenor sax, in replacement of departing Bud Johnson, as well as vocalist Sarah Vaughan. In late 1942, Vaughan had won an amateur contest at the Apollo Theater, claiming a prize of $10 and a week-long engagement at the famous venue. Hines heard her at the Apollo and, impressed by her vocal skills and range, which spanned almost three octaves, offered her a job with his orchestra. Now still in her teens, Vaughan was sharing the bandstand with the two greatest talents of the new generation of jazz players. But the young vocalist was singularly well-equipped to thrive in this setting. Like the beboppers who flaunted their virtuosity, Vaughan had unsurpassed technical fluency and a fondness for ornate phrasing. She also shared the beboppers' deep grasp of harmony and, like a growing number of them, could demonstrate it with some facility on the piano. In fact, her original role in the Hines band had her serving as vocalist and backup pianist to Hines. In her range, her skill in navigating difficult interval leaps, her instinct for the grand gesture, her expressive mastery of tones and timbres, Vaughan seemed closer in spirit to Gillespie than to other jazz singers. It comes as little surprise that jazz historians cite Vaughan as evoking an essentially horn-like style of vocals. Gillespie, responding to the inspiration of this new addition to the band, began showing an interest in writing parts to back Vaughan's singing. Gillespie's Night in Tunisia, which would become a bop anthem, dates from this period and was originally recorded, although not until the end of 1944, with a Vaughan vocal under the name Interlude. In later years, Vaughan, like many jazz vocalists, tempered her bop proclivities in pursuit of a more mainstream pop-oriented style. Drawing heavily on the Tin Pan Alley tradition, she made memorable recordings of various songbooks of composers such as Gershwin, Rogers, and Berlin. In time, her reputation as a jazz diva came to be matched by deserved respect as an interpreter of popular music, but rarely would her later work find her in a jazz setting as inspiring as the Heinz Band of the war years. Or so one suspects. Unfortunately, the recording ban prevented this edition of the Heinz Band from ever entering the studio. Certainly no commercial recordings were made, and no taped broadcasts, so common with other bands from this period, have materialized. The 1943 Earl Hines Orchestra ranks only slightly below the Buddy Bolden Band as the most important unrecorded ensemble in the history of jazz. Nor do later recordings by the band provide much information. Hines was unable to retain this all-star lineup of emerging stars for long, and by the time he returned to the studio, the group had lost its key soloists. Little Benny Harris left in July 1943, and Parker departed in August. Soon after, Billy Eckstein quit to form his own band, eventually bringing with him some of Hines's finest talents, including Gillespie and Vaughan. A powerful singer with a resonant baritone voice, Eckstein had recorded the hit Jelly Jelly while with the Hines Band, and now was interested in building on that success. As it turned out, his fascination with the cutting-edge sounds of bop may have compromised his success as a pop singer. Under somewhat different circumstances, Eckstein might have approached the popularity of a Nat King Cole or even a Frank Sinatra, but the broader audience he sought mostly eluded him. This early 1940s Eckstein band, the most important of his career, did little to help his prospects, dividing critics and making little headway with the general public. Yet its solid musicianship and modern jazz ethos established it as a major forerunner to the bop big bands of Gillespie, Woody Herman, and others. But Eckstein, like Hines, found it difficult to retain his star soloists, many of whom were leaving to work in the small combo format that would come to dominate the bebop idiom. The mainstreaming of bebop. The landscape of jazz was now changing in tandem with the music. In the years leading up to World War II, a few small jazz clubs had set up business in the ground floor of the brownstone apartments on 52nd Street between 5th Avenue and 7th Avenue. As the music's audience shifted from dance aficionados to serious listeners, these clubs gained distinction as the new center of the jazz universe. Close enough to Times Square to draw visitors, servicemen on leave, and patrons of New York theater and nightlife. Today this urban landscape is dotted with banks and retail stores. The last jazz club shut its doors in 1968. But while the glory days lasted, this stretch of less than a half kilometer was the epicenter of hot, improvised music in America. The arrival of bebop on 52nd Street marked a signal event, initiated by Dizzy Gillespie's stint with a small combo at the Onyx Club in early 1944. Gillespie had sent a telegram to Kansas City enlisting Charlie Parker's participation, but Bird never replied to, and perhaps never received, the missive. Gillespie had also hoped to have Bud Powell on piano, but eventually settled for George Wallington, a young white player well-versed in the new style. But even without Parker and Powell, this band was destined to make a tremendous impact on the jazz scene. To complement Wallington in the rhythm section, Gillespie relied on Oscar Pettiford, who, along with Charles Mingus and Ray Brown, would come to rank among the preeminent bassists playing in the Jimmy Blanton tradition of full-tone swing, and drummer Max Roach. In time, Roach would rival Kenny Clarke as the leading exponent of bop drumming. A native of the Carolinas like Gillespie and Monk, Roach had made a name for himself while still in his mid-teens as house drummer for the sessions at Monroe's Uptown House. Now, together with Pettiford, he provided Gillespie with a progressive rhythm section, capable of playing at the fastest tempos without losing the flowing legato that the modern style required. Gillespie eventually expanded the band to a quintet with the addition of Don Byas, a Hawkins-inspired tenor saxophonist who stood out as one of the few swing-era horn players who successfully adapted to the demands of bebop. The inevitable appearance of Charlie Parker on 52nd Street in September 1944 for an engagement at the Three Deuces built on the interest generated by Gillespie's band. Now elevated from the after-hours clubs and jam sessions of its early days, bebop was legitimized by its presentation in quasi-respectable venues. Moreover, the reverberations of modern jazz, already fueled by word of mouth, were now being amplified by commercial recordings and radio broadcasts. In this context, critics and journalists felt compelled to deal with this new music, if only as a fad or phenomenon, although the early reactions of the mainstream media were almost uniformly unfavorable. An article in Collier's proclaimed, "You can't sing it, you can't dance it, maybe you can't even stand it, it's bebop." Time magazine, struggling to define bebop for its readers, explained that it was hot jazz overheated with overdone lyrics full of bawdiness, references to narcotics, and double talk. Prominent musicians of the old school also chimed in with invective. Cab Calloway and others denounced modern jazz as Chinese music. Louis Armstrong lambasted all them weird chords which don't mean nothing. You got no melody to remember and no beat to dance to. Benny Goodman complained that modern jazz players were not real musicians. They were just faking. Traditional cornetist Doc Evans went so far as to hold a mock funeral for bebop. Downbeat, which delighted in the controversy, ran a photo commemorating the event. Before 1945, only a few recordings of this new music had been available to the general public, but now several small record companies, such as Guild and Savoy, began to sense opportunities in promoting the modern jazz idiom. On February 9th, Gillespie recorded an impressive performance of Blue and Boogie with a band that also included saxophonist Dexter Gordon. Less than 3 weeks later, Parker and Gillespie recorded several historic sides, including Dizzy Atmosphere and Groovin' High. On Dizzy Atmosphere, Parker floats over the changes, flirting with polytonality during the second 8 bars and executing a stunning rhythmic displacement in the bridge. Gillespie follows with a virtuoso's bag of tricks, dancing leaps into the high register, intricate repeated passages, odd intervals, and choppy change-up phrases. Groovin' High, Gillespie's reworking of the song Whispering, and All the Things You Are were more subdued, with Parker contributing supple solos somewhat reminiscent of his Lester Young roots. In May, Parker and Gillespie were reunited at a session that produced Salt Peanuts, noteworthy for a scalding Gillespie contribution that stands out as one of the most dramatic brass solos in the history of jazz. In November, Gillespie rejoined Parker for a session under the latter's leadership for the Savoy label. Two blues songs from that date, Billy's Bounce and Now's the Time, would garner respect as classic performances, studied and emulated by many other musicians. But even more impressive was the version of Coco recorded that day. This reworking of Cherokee opens with an eerie introduction, perhaps the most famous in jazz since Armstrong's clarion call to kick off West End Blues, bobbing and weaving phrases played without harmonic support, anticipating the ambiguous tonality employed by Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry some 15 years later. This is followed by one of Parker's finest solos, two full choruses of driving bebop that few other saxophonists of the day could have played, let alone improvised. A few days after this session, Gillespie and Parker left New York to bring a bebop band to Southern California for an engagement at Billy Berg's, an upscale nightclub known for its name jazz acts and its, rare at the time, racially integrated audiences. Los Angeles listeners had already enjoyed a small taste of this new music in the local performances of a bop band led by Coleman Hawkins, as well as through the modern jazz recordings that were making their way out west. Now, L.A. jazz buffs had 6 weeks to assess the music as played by its greatest innovators. Audiences were intrigued, if not captivated, by the band, but local musicians were clearly paying close attention to the modernistic concepts of Parker and Gillespie. By this time, Parker's addiction and unstable behavior were increasingly evident to outsiders, the private life of the altoist filtering into the public persona. On any given night, he might skip a performance or arrive late. Finally, at the close of the Los Angeles engagement, Bird missed the flight home. As a result, his planned 6-week stay in California would stretch out to over 60 weeks, 15 tumultuous months that witnessed some of Byrd's finest music-making, but were equally clouded by periods of disillusion. In the first weeks following Gillespie's departure, Parker continued to flourish. Ross Russell, proprietor of a local record store, had attempted to set up a studio session with Parker and Gillespie at the close of the Billy Berg's gig, but Byrd never showed up for the date. Undaunted, Russell decided to record Parker as a leader, using local and visiting musicians as sidemen. In exchange for a $100 advance, Parker agreed to record exclusively with a Dial label for the next year. For the first session under Parker's leadership, Russell engaged a band that included trumpeter Miles Davis, only 19 years old and recently arrived in California with a Benny Carter band, tenorist Lucky Thompson, and a rhythm section composed of pianist Dodo Marmarosa, bassist Vic McMillan, guitarist Arv Garrison, and drummer Roy Porter. The Dial work, judged as a whole, contains much of Parker's finest music, but this initial date proved especially memorable. Only 4 compositions were recorded, but each ranks as a bop masterpiece. Moose the Mooch, named by Parker for his L.A. narcotic supplier, features a clever stop-and-start melody over I Got Rhythm Changes. Drummer Porter reports that Parker wrote the lead sheet during the drive to the studio, and stellar alto solos on all the takes. On Yardbird Suite and Ornithology, Parker provides whirlwind 32-bar solos, but the highlight of the session was Night in Tunisia. This Gillespie composition sets up the first soloist with an interlude leading into a 4-bar break. Parker uses this break to execute a mesmerizing double-time jazz cadenza. Few jazz reed players could approach the sheer speed of this passage, but even more impressive is the rhythmic phrasing in which coy accents, oddly placed in crevices between the beats, impart a bobbing, weaving quality to the horn line. Parker follows up with a sleek 16-bar solo, which for all its merits is overshadowed by the previous 4-bar explosion. If this session displayed Parker at his best, the next recording date finds him at his nadir. His physical condition had deteriorated markedly in the intervening weeks. In addition to ingesting whatever narcotics he could procure, Parker was drinking heavily. Around the same time he developed a nervous twitch. His arms would shoot up in the air uncontrollably, sometimes in mid-performance. His playing, so spontaneous and fresh in his first weeks on the West Coast, now often sounded strained and inconsistent. Those close to him feared that he was at the breaking point. "I thought he was going to die," Miles Davis later recalled. Howard McGee confided to Russell that he felt Parker was cracking up. Despite these warning signs, Russell scheduled a session for July 29th. He persevered even when Byrd arrived at the studio in an almost comatose state, and despite the warning of Dr. Richard Freeman, a psychiatrist who was the brother of Russell's partner, that Parker was showing symptoms of alcoholism and malnutrition. After all, hadn't Parker played brilliantly in the past, despite similar bouts of dissipation? The first number recorded that day went poorly. Dr. Freeman responded by giving Parker 6 tablets of phenobarbital. To complete the following take of Loverman, Parker needed to be supported from behind, and even then can be heard to stagger away from the microphone. "He was turning around and around, and his horn was shooting up in the air," Howard McGee has related. Charles Mingus would later praise this as one of Parker's most powerful solos. McGee also defended the performance, arguing that, despite Byrd's state, the sound came out fine, there are no wrong notes. Few other commentators have agreed. Parker's tone, usually so taut, sounds flabby, and his phrasing is hesitant, indecisive. The most telling verdict came from Parker himself, who was incensed when Loverman was released by Dial. Had the fiasco stopped there, the Loverman session would have been merely an unfortunate episode in Parker's career. As it was, events took an even more ominous turn in the hours following the recording. At his hotel that evening, Parker wandered into the lobby naked, and later that night set his room afire, perhaps falling asleep while smoking. When the police arrived, they forcibly subdued him, placed him in handcuffs, and took him to jail. Eventually, Russell tracked him down and managed to have Parker transferred to the state hospital at Camarillo, located 70 miles north of Los Angeles. The following 6 months stand out as an unusual interlude in Parker's career. During the first weeks at Camarillo, Byrd took little notice of his surroundings, and the doctors talked of applying electroshock treatment. The idea was dropped as Parker became more alert and involved in his day-to-day regimen. By the second month, he was tending vegetables in the hospital garden and telling visitors it was a gas. He also laid bricks and talked of becoming a mason. Not that he had forgotten about music. The hospital had its own Saturday night band, and Parker joined in on C Melody saxophone. By the time of his release, Parker was no doubt in the best shape of his adult life and, thoughts of masonry left far behind, ready to resume his jazz career. The first session after Bird's release gives little hint of this renewal. On these sides, Parker insisted on featuring vocalist Earl Coleman, a smooth baritone in the mold of Billy Eckstein, and only a glimmer of Parker's improvisational acumen shines through. A week later, however, Parker undertook a combo recording that found him in the company of a strong bop band that included tenorist Wardell Gray, trumpeter McGee, and pianist Dodo Marmarosa. Relaxin' at Camarillo from this date is one of Parker's finest compositions, a sinuous blues with a free rhythmic quality to its melody line. On these tracks, and in performances with McGee at the Heidi Ho Club, Parker made it clear that his playing had reached a new level, as compelling as before, but more pliant, less intense. The coy title of the Camarillo tribute was no false claim. His work increasingly reflected the relaxed command of an established master, rather than the irreverent challenges of a young revolutionary. This new sound would, for a time, coexist with the earlier, more insistent style, finally becoming dominant in Parker's later recordings for Norman Granz. The relative merits of the later and earlier Bird continue to generate debate in jazz circles, with most jazz devotees finding reasons to criticize the eventual mainstreaming of Charlie Parker. But few can dispute the underlying truth that this change symbolized. Within a few years of its revolutionary arrival on the scene, bebop was no longer a radical underground movement. As surprising as its early disruption of the swing-era pieties was the speed with which modern jazz was accepted as part of the mainstream sound of the music. In April, Parker returned to New York, his reputation only enhanced by the tumultuous events of the previous 15 months. The New York jazz scene had changed in the intervening period, with bebop in the ascendancy and the swing era in its final days. Just the previous December, 8 major big bands had broken up, including those led by Goodman, James, and Dorsey, in the face of the changed jazz landscape. Now a cadre of new bebop players was making their presence felt. When Gillespie had returned to New York the previous year, he had hired alto saxophonist Sonny Stitt to take Parker's place in the band. Stitt, who had apprenticed in Billy Eckstein's orchestra, was the only altoist on the scene who could approach Parker in terms of speed and technique. His style may have been derivative. Despite his protestations to the contrary, his approach often sounded like a careful imitation of Bird's. But Stitt, at his best, was a spectacular soloist. In jam sessions, he could be a devastating opponent, and Stitt delighted in such encounters, with many of his finest performances made in the heat of battle with Gene Ammons, Eddie Lockjaw Davis, Stan Getz, Sonny Rollins, and others. In later years, he often played the tenor sax, on which his style was less akin to Parker's, and showed that, in addition to his skill in building elaborate bop superstructures, Stitt also knew how to probe the depths of the blues. In the Eckstein band, Stitt had worked with trumpeter Fats Navarro, a Florida native who was another up-and-coming master of the bop idiom. Navarro managed to incorporate the intricate improvisational lines of Gillespie into a more controlled style. His was a music of contradictions. His tone was sweeter and smoother than Gillespie's, with greater use of the tongue in articulating notes, in contrast to Dizzy's more slurred attack, but his overall style was still hot and swinging. Much of Navarro's best work was as a sideman with Bud Powell on Whale, on The Squirrel and The Chase with Tad Dameron, alongside Benny Goodman on Stealin' Apples or on Ornithology with Charlie Parker. Discographers tell us that the latter performance was recorded at Birdland only a few days before Navarro died from tuberculosis in 1950 at age 26, an assertion almost impossible to believe given the forcefulness and absolute command of Navarro's playing. Under different circumstances, Navarro's reputation might have matched Clifford Brown's or even Miles Davis's. Instead, he left behind just a handful of tracks that leave us musing over what this deeply gifted musician might have achieved with more time. Navarro's frequent employer, Tad Dameron, was, for his part, an unlikely modern jazz player. Was Dameron a real bebopper? His compositions are often cited as model bop pieces, but many of the best known were written in the late 1930s before the new movement had crystallized. His early roots straddled musical idioms. As an arranger, he was equally comfortable working for swing bands such as Lunsford's and Basie's, or writing for modern jazz ensembles led by Gillespie and Eckstein. Moreover, his approach to the piano had none of the telltale signs of bop. It lacked the insistent linear drive of a Bud Powell, as well as the hypermodern harmonic sense of a Thelonious Monk. Instead, Dameron favored a more thoughtful approach, and even his improvisations have a tendency to sound like structured compositions, not surprising, perhaps, given his overriding interest in writing. Almost from the start of the bop movement, Dameron's songs have been favored by the new generation of jazz players, with Sarah Vaughan recording If You Could See Me Now, and Gillespie relying on Hot House, Dameron's reworking of What Is This Thing Called Love, as a regular feature number. Many of his other pieces, Good Bait, Our Delight, and Lady Bird, have also become part of the standard jazz repertoire. By temperament, Dameron might have been inclined to focus on composing, but earning a livelihood in the jazz world in the mid-1940s was difficult without toiling nightly as a performer. Hence, Dameron increasingly gravitated toward the club scene. It was a fortuitous decision. A lengthy stint at the Royal Roost found Dameron fronting an outstanding house band, which also included Navarro and drummer Clark. Later Dameron bands featured Clifford Brown and Miles Davis. By the mid-1950s, Dameron had become inactive, due partly to his reserved personality, but even more to a growing dependence on narcotics, a problem that eventually led to incarceration. Between his release in 1961 and his death in 1965, Dameron attempted to re-enter the fray of the jazz world, but never with more than passing success. But of all the modern jazz players who graced the New York scene at the time of Parker's return, Gillespie still reigned as the only one who not only could approach Bird in terms of raw talent, but also possessed a charismatic stage presence that might bring the new modern sounds to a wider audience. Seizing the opportunity generated by his growing reputation, Gillespie formed a bebop big band in 1946. Larger ensembles would continue to fascinate Gillespie for the rest of his career, despite the economic challenge of maintaining a big band in the post-war years. Yet Gillespie never needed the larger unit, as, say, Ellington did, to define his musical aspirations. Gillespie invariably hired outsiders to write charts and organize the band. The trumpeter was content to front the group and play the role of star soloist. For his post-war band, the role of musical director fell to Gil Fuller, who had worked with Dizzy in the Eckstein Ensemble. On charts such as Things to Come, Manteca, and Ray's Idea, Fuller provided Gillespie with a suitably modernistic setting to showcase this doyen of the bebop movement. Gillespie's interest in Afro-Cuban music also continued to develop during this period. As early as 1938, Gillespie had spoken to Mario Balsa about the potential for using a conga player in a jazz band. Some 9 years passed before Gillespie, now fronting his own big band, was ready to make the move. Consulting again with Balsa, Dizzy was introduced to Chano Pozo, an exciting conga player who spoke little English, read no music, but was a master of Cuban rhythms. Although their collaboration was short-lived, Pozo was killed in a Harlem altercation the following year. It set a precedent rich in implications for both Gillespie and the jazz world as a whole. True, there had been earlier attempts to fuse Latin music with jazz, but none had the symbolic impact of Gillespie's appearance with Pozo on the stage of Carnegie Hall in September 1947. Jelly Roll Morton is often seen as the originator of this fusion of styles. After all, he had suggested, in an often-quoted remark, that the Spanish tinge was the right seasoning for jazz, and backed up these words with his own artful compositions and performances, The Crave, Mamanita, Creepy Feeling. But even earlier rag composers such as Scott Joplin had explored the habanera rhythm, which is the basis for the tango. This rhythm shows up in Joplin's Solace and in the second theme of W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. The popularization of dances such as the tango and later the rumba also furthered the acceptance of Latin music in the United States. Yet the missing ingredient, a distinctly Afro-Cuban perspective on jazz, did not appear in any meaningful degree until the 1940s. Spurred then partly by the growing attention of jazz players to its potential, but even more by the influx of Cuban musicians into the New York music scene. Mario Balsa left Cuba for New York in 1930 and, as we have seen, furthered Gillespie's interest in this music during their joint venture in the Cab Calloway Band. The Cuban vocalist Machito followed, coming to New York in 1937, where in later years his band, the Afro-Cubans, made pioneering steps in fusing jazz harmonies with Cuban melodies and rhythmic patterns. Around this same time, Duke Ellington found some success with his recording of Juan Tisol's Caravan, but though this composition is now considered a milestone in the evolution of Latin jazz, most listeners at the time heard more of the Middle East than Tisol's native Puerto Rico in the recording. Even a decade later, when Stan Kenton added Machito and two percussionists from the Afro-Cubans to his band for his 1947 hit recording of The Peanut Vendor, made a few weeks after Gillespie and Pozzo's Carnegie Hall concert, the mixture of Latin and jazz elements was still considered by big band fans as more a novelty than the sign of the emerging salsa style, which would eventually stand out as an important and vibrant musical idiom in its own right. In this context, Gillespie's passionate advocacy of Afro-Cuban styles, or Cubop as his hybrid approach came to be known for a time, served as the key turning point, building on earlier forays and giving these new sounds a visibility that no doubt inspired other major jazz artists to explore the Afro-Cuban nexus. The move from bebop to cubop did not come easily. Although both Pozzo and Gillespie could trace their cultural heritage back to overlapping African roots, the later evolution of their respective musical vocabularies had taken them to far different points. The clave rhythm, central to Cuban music, was antithetical to the more open pulse of modern jazz, and the song structures that permeated jazz felt equally constraining to Pozzo, who preferred the freedom of the montuno vamps of his native music. Gillespie wanted to draw on Pozzo's instincts as a composer, but much of the burden fell on Dizzy and his collaborators, Fuller and George Russell, to transform Pozzo's simple constructs into full-fledged pieces. In the face of these conflicting traditions, a healthy dose of give and take proved essential. On Manteca, Gillespie contributed a contrasting theme to soften the insistence of Pozzo's main melody. On Cubana B, Cubana Bop, Russell and Gillespie provided Pozzo with an unstructured interlude to feature his playing in an open-ended solo. On other pieces, the band vacillated between jazz and Cuban rhythms, unsure where to anchor their beat. Did these compromises work? George Russell's description of the crowd's reaction to the premiere of Cubana B, Cubana Bop reflects the upside potential of this meeting of musical minds. The audience was in a state of shock. They didn't believe that an orchestra could really rise to that level of excitement and innovation. But with Pozzo, as with Parker, Gillespie was dealing with an unstable personality. Chana was a hoodlum, a rough character, bassist Al McKibben explains. Gillespie, in his autobiography, describes him as a roughneck. Pozzo carried a long knife with him wherever he went, as well as a bullet permanently lodged in his spine, a carryover from a disagreement over royalties. And like Parker, Pozzo did not live to see his 35th birthday, his lifestyle on the edge eventually exacting its toll. Pozzo was shot in a New York barroom in December 1948, only 14 months after his triumphant Carnegie Hall debut with Dizzy Gillespie. That same Carnegie Hall performance also featured a much-anticipated reunion of Gillespie with Charlie Parker. These encounters would be rare from now on. Parker was fronting his own group with Miles Davis on trumpet, while Gillespie was preoccupied with his larger band. Yet each of the recorded meetings between these two leading lights of modern jazz produced substantial music. At Carnegie Hall, Parker pushed the band relentlessly on Dizzy Atmosphere, letting loose with a virtuosic solo of the highest order. Who could follow such a solo? Perhaps only Gillespie. Spitting out scorching, jagged phrases, Gillespie played one of the strongest and almost certainly the fastest solos of his career. Again at the Clef record date in 1950 and at the Massey Hall concert in 1953, Parker and Gillespie would spur each other to create some of the most memorable performances of the bebop idiom. For his day-to-day working band, Parker had enlisted a trumpeter who would eventually come to represent the opposite stylistic pole to Gillespie's heated pyrotechnics. Miles Davis, the future leader of the cool movement, would seem an unlikely choice to share the front line with a firebrand altoist. Some have suggested this was only part of a long-standing pattern of Parker's. Time and again, his musical instincts led him to hire trumpeters who would counterbalance rather than mimic his high-powered improvisations. With Davis, with Chet Baker, with Kenny Dorham, with Red Rodney, Parker invariably reached for a more low-key and reflective melodic voice, a tonic to offset his acidic alto lines. But then again, this interpretation may be reading too much into Miles Davis, circa 1947. Davis at that time was still under Gillespie's spell, struggling to fit his introverted temperament into the latter's extroverted style. On Fast Numbers, here his attempts to follow Parker on Donnelly, Davis is anything but calm and collected. His phrasing is nervous, his articulation suspect. Yet Parker must have seen, if not the future birth of the cool, at least some diamond in the rough in this teenage acolyte, hints of greatness that the surviving recordings from that period do not show. After all, Byrd, who could have his pick more or less of any trumpeter, opted for unknown and unheralded Miles Dewey Davis. Davis, even then, was an enigma. Raised in an affluent environment in St. Louis, he exhibited a street-smart toughness that seemed more in tune with life on the wrong side of the tracks. Davis's father was a successful dental surgeon with 3 degrees, who also owned a 200-acre farm. As late as 1962, when Miles was earning a 6-figure income, he would boast that his father was worth more than he was. His uncle was educated at Harvard and had studied in Germany. Yet this scion of a successful family came to be dubbed the Prince of Darkness by some. No carefree nickname, Fats or Sonny for him. And the title matched the moods of this aloof man who associated with prizefighters, filled his autobiography with expletives, and left behind a litter of strained relationships. Contradictions run through his entire life story. A fierce critic of established hierarchies, Miles chose Juilliard for his musical education, the ultimate outsider opting for the insider's path, then giving it all away to shadow Parker in the early boppers, again gravitating to the periphery. Once established as a mainstay of the bebop movement, he abandoned that course as well, espousing a radical new style, the cool, as it came to be known. Then again, renouncing this new love to pursue other dalliances, with modal, impressionist, hard bop, and quasi-free styles, and ultimately a controversy-provoking leap into jazz rock fusion. But most of all, the enigma comes in trying to reconcile the man and his music. One, all hard surfaces, the other, mostly smooth contours. There are no easy answers or glib one-paragraph summaries when one deals with Miles Davis. Born in Alton, Illinois, on May 26, 1926, Davis moved with his family to East St. Louis when he was still an infant. His father, also named Miles, the trumpeter possessed the elegant formal name of Miles Dewey Davis III, set a tone for achievement that the son strived to match, in his own contrary way, for the rest of his life. The boy's relationship with his mother, Cleota Henry Davis, was more complex. She viewed his musical pursuits with suspicion, and it wasn't until he was an adult that Miles learned that she was an accomplished pianist. She sat down one day and played some funky blues, he remembered with astonishment. Davis's parents eventually separated, with mother and son never fully coming to terms. When she died, Davis did not even attend her funeral. Yet her recordings of Tatum and Ellington introduced Miles to the music he would ultimately embrace. But when Cleota planned to give her son a violin for his 13th birthday, her husband stepped in to insist that the trumpet was a better choice. Under the tutelage of a local instructor, Miles made some progress, but developed more rapidly when he came under the sway of Elwood Buchanan, a jazz trumpeter who had recently been on the road with the Andy Kirk Band. Buchanan directed Davis's attention to jazz players such as Harold Baker and Bobby Hackett, unusual choices outside of the Oliver Armstrong-Eldridge orbit, but perhaps stimulating ones given Miles's later gravitation toward the cool. By his mid-teens, other influences and techniques were being assimilated. Through additional lessons with the first trumpeter in the St. Louis Symphony, he said I was the worst trumpet player he ever heard in his life, as well as through friends who shared his enthusiasm for jazz, such as pianist Duke Brooks and trumpeter Clark Terry, the latter also destined to become a major jazz artist. By the close of his high school years, Davis seemed poised for a promising musical career. He was playing professional gigs and making some money from music. At home, relations with his mother were strained, and his parents finally separated around the time Miles graduated from high school. His mother, with whom he stayed after the breakup, wanted him to attend Fisk, but Miles protested that he would be better served by studying music at Juilliard. Miles's father intervened in favor of his son's choice. In September 1944, Miles arrived in New York, passed his audition at the conservatory, and enrolled as a student. As it turned out, Davis acquired a first-rate musical education in New York, but one in which the Juilliard School of Music played little part. Instead, Miles's classrooms of choice were Minton's, the Savoy Ballroom, the Three Deuces, the Onyx, the Spotlight, and other centers of jazz activity. but he was mostly drawn to the new generation of bebop players, then making a name for themselves on the New York scene. I spent my first week in New York looking for Bird and Dizzy. Man, I went everywhere looking for those two cats, Davis wrote in his autobiography. Finally, he tracked down Parker at a Harlem Jam session. Although he was only 24 years old at the time, just 6 years older than Miles, Parker soon took on a fatherly role with the young trumpeter, encouraging him, introducing him to other musicians, and eventually hiring him as a sideman. Davis's approach to the trumpet was now evolving into a streamlined modern jazz style. Here Dizzy was an obvious role model, not just for Miles, but for a whole generation. But perhaps just as influential was the more controlled and sweeter-toned work of Freddie Webster and Fats Navarro. Surrounded by these extraordinary players, Davis soon lost what little interest he retained in studies at Juilliard, and eventually dropped out of the conservatory. These were heady surroundings, and Miles was still in the process of coming to grips with his playing. His lines suffered by comparison with his models, lacking the balance and clarity of a Navarro or Webster, the electricity of a Gillespie. Yet when Parker went into the studio to record for Savoy in November 1945, he brought Miles along on trumpet, an even more telling decision when one considers that Dizzy was also present that day, but enlisted to play piano. This was an extreme vote of confidence in the 19-year-old trumpeter. On the blues numbers recorded at the session, Billy's Bounce, Now's the Time, Davis contributes thoughtful, if somewhat cautious, solos. But when the band came to record Coco, the fast showpiece based on Cherokee Changes, Miles simply refused to play. "I wasn't going to get out there and embarrass myself," Davis later explained. "I didn't really think I was ready." The choice was fortuitous. Gillespie stepped in for Davis and played a commanding solo on what was destined to become the most important bebop side to date at the time of its release. When Parker left for Los Angeles in December 1945, Davis decided to follow him, using a gig with Benny Carter's band as a way of getting to the West Coast. In Los Angeles, Davis played with Bird at the Finale, and again recorded with him for the Dial label. After Parker was committed to Camarillo, Davis went on the road with Billy Eckstine and then returned to New York, where he worked with Gillespie's big band. Has there ever been a more spectacular trumpet section than the one Dizzy brought to an April 1947 gig in the Bronx with, in addition to Davis and Gillespie, Fats Navarro, Freddie Webster, and Kenny Dorham? Parker, now back on the scene, occasionally sat in with the band. But Bird, now at the peak of his career, was no longer content to work regularly as a sideman or even co-leader with Gillespie. In April 1947, Parker opened with his new quintet at the Three Deuces on 52nd Street. In forming his new group, Bird again selected Davis along with Max Roach, bassist Tommy Potter, and pianist Duke Jordan. The following month, Parker brought this band into the studio to record for the Savoy label, the only change being the substitution of Bud Powell for Duke Jordan. The melody line for Donna Lee, a classic performance recorded that day, has sometimes been attributed to Davis, but the claim is hard to believe. With its rich chromaticism, it comes the closest of any of Parker's themes to matching his style of improvisation. Chasin' the Bird from the same session is equally noteworthy, with Parker abandoning the standard unison lines of his melodies in favor of some clever counterpoint. In the closing months of 1947, Parker returned to the studio once each month with his working band to record again for Russell's Dial label, now relocated back east. The most ambitious piece from these three sessions, The Hymn, attempts to recreate the excitement of Coco with a blistering tempo and a melody built, like Cherokee, mostly on whole and half notes. Parker obliges with a busy solo, impressive but without the edge of its famous predecessor. Parker also contributes several solid, medium-tempo originals, Scrapple from the Apple, Dewey Square, Dexterity, on which he solos with aplomb. In a surprising twist, however, Parker's most memorable performances from these final Dial sessions are the slowest pieces. This too revealed an important side of the new Charlie Parker, more reflective and singularly rhapsodic. Embraceable You, perhaps Parker's finest ballad recording, is a masterpiece of thematic development, which builds from a simple six-note motif, reminiscent of the "You Must Remember This" phrase from As Time Goes By. My Old Flame and Don't Blame Me, also from this late Dial period, are only a notch below Embraceable You in quality. In their own way, these performances constituted a new step forward in the history of the jazz ballad, as influential as Beiderbecke and Trumbauer's work on Singin' the Blues, Armstrong's I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Young's collaborations with Billie Holiday, and Coleman Hawkins's 1 Hour and Body and Soul. Here, too, the rest of the band falls short of Parker, offering a lugubrious four-to-the-bar accompaniment. In a few years, jazz rhythm sections would become much more relaxed in playing these very slow tempos. But Parker's silky improvisations overcome this liability, pointing the way toward a new, more romantic dimension of the bebop idiom, and delineating a noteworthy expansion of its musical territory. For the final Dial session, Parker and Davis were joined in the front line by trombonist J.J. Johnson, who had already impressed listeners with his recordings as a leader for the Savoy label, as well as in sideman stints with Benny Carter, Count Basie, and others. To Johnson fell the unenviable responsibility of translating the advances of modern jazz into the language of the slide trombone. The speed and intricacy of bebop lines made them especially recalcitrant to this transformation, and it is a credit to Johnson's virtuosity and tenacity that he succeeded so well at such a Herculean task. The Parker sides helped to boost an already promising career. They were followed by a series of Johnson collaborations with other leading modern jazz performers, including Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, and Stan Getz. Despite the accolades of jazz insiders, Johnson's career dipped for a time in the early 1950s, and he was forced to take a day job as a blueprint inspector at a Long Island factory. But in 1955, Johnson finally won the downbeat poll on his instrument and began enjoying greater success as a leader, often in conjunction with fellow trombonist Kai Winding. In later years, however, Johnson often recoiled from the stresses and strains involved in leading a jazz band, sometimes focusing instead on arranging and composition, with works ranging from the plaintive ballad Lament to highly ambitious pieces such as the six-movement Perceptions, recorded in 1961 by Günther Schuller with Gillespie as featured soloist, and at other times taking on more commercial work in the music industry. After the late 1960s, Johnson's public appearances became increasingly rare, and he retired from the stage in 1996, 5 years before his death from suicide in the midst of a long illness. Yet despite the ups and downs of his career, Johnson's legacy is secure, and virtually all later jazz trombonists, except only the most traditional, owe a greater or lesser debt to his pioneering efforts. 4 days after his final Dial session, Parker returned to the studio with his working band, this time under the auspices of the Savoy label. Here, the compositions are more perfunctory, mere excuses for a blowing date, and, as with the late Dial work, the level of intensity is a notch lower than on Parker's pre-Camarillo recordings. Parker's two Savoy sessions from the following year are much stronger, featuring more probing compositions in new styles, such as the Latin-inflected Barbados and the counterpoint exercise Alucha. But again, the most powerful performance comes on a slow number, this time the stunning blues Parker's Mood, which marked a surprising return to Parker's Kansas City roots. Renouncing the virtuosity, the arcane chord substitutions, the fast tempos, the very trademarks of the Byrd sound, Parker created one of his most gut-wrenching performances, a quasi-vocal horn lament that, in its starkness, is almost the antithesis of the maximalist leanings of his mid-1940s work. Of course, the more intense side of Parker's music still flourished, but in this later stage of his career, it was more evident outside the studio, in the many amateur recordings of his public performances and private jam sessions. This underground Parker is extensively documented. The Dean Benedetti tapes and discs alone, which came to light in the late 1980s, include more than 400 previously unknown Parker solos. But this represents only a small part of the bootleg Byrd. In addition, jazz fans are blessed with recorded performances from the Royal Roost, Onyx, the Three Deuces, Byrdland, Rockland Palace, Carnegie Hall with Ella Fitzgerald, the Renaissance Ballroom with an unknown Latin band, indeed at almost every conceivable type of New York venue from high to low, as well as on the road in Detroit, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Boston, even Sweden from Parker's celebrated 1950 visit, among other locales. Then there are even more unusual, more private recordings, the results of informal encounters in apartments, hotel rooms, and the like. The sound quality of this massive, unofficial legacy ranges from adequate to nightmarish, but Parker's playing rarely lags. Especially during the final 6 years of his life, much of Parker's best work, and certainly his most impassioned, comes to us through the surface noise of these tinny-sounding amateur sessions. Such acoustic horrors remind me of a friend's comment about his grandpa's privately distilled whiskey. If it were any worse, you couldn't stand it. If it were any better, you couldn't get enough. For the most part, only devotees of bop will endure the labor of wading through the buzzes and scratches of this poorly recorded material. But those who are able to tune their ears to the glories of the music are rewarded with some of modern jazz's most intoxicating moments. In contrast to these uninhibited documents of bop on the fly, Parker's late studio recordings for producer Norman Granz reflect a more homogenized bird. Here, snippets of intense improvisation coexist with overtly commercial attempts to package Parker for the mass market. There was some irony in this turn of events. After all, Granz was one of the best jazz record producers of the period, a stickler for using the finest musicians, both as leaders and sidemen, and putting them in settings where they could play unadulterated jazz. In fact, Granz had been responsible for the inspired 1946 pairing of Parker and Lester Young that produced a classic recording of "O Lady Be Good." But Parker's 1949-54 sessions for Granz rarely approached the level of this one earlier work. Two Granz dates from 1950 are among the best of the lot, notably Parker's June reunion with Gillespie, backed by the fascinating, if unconventional, combination of Buddy Rich and Thelonious Monk in the rhythm section. The low point of this period is the inept mixture of Parker and the Dave Lambert singers, with the results that are almost unlistenable. Only slightly more successful are the recordings with a string orchestra, in which saccharine arrangements overwhelm Parker's valiant attempts to make serious music. Parker was reportedly pleased with this effort, especially with his performance of Just Friends, and his playing was no doubt poised. Nonetheless, the music has not worn well with the passing years, and jazz fans justifiably lament the missed opportunity to record Parker with other star players associated with Granz. A session planned with Art Tatum never materialized, but what a gem it might have been. Or in more sophisticated orchestral settings. Even the work with Latin musicians, marketed as Charlie Parker Plays South of the Border, which showed some promise, still failed to match the more exciting Gillespie projects in this vein. In general, Gillespie's work with Granz was more uniformly successful. This collaboration flourished in the 1950s and was renewed in the 1970s when Granz formed his Pablo label. Granz tempered Dizzy's tendency to take the easy way out with novelty songs, offbeat vocals, and crowd-pleasing antics, and instead consistently placed him in the midst of other world-class players. A close study of Gillespie's recording career validates the wisdom of this move. With very few exceptions, Dizzy's strongest solos came when he shared the front line with another leading horn player, Parker, Stitt, Eldridge, Getz, Rollins, and other peers. In these settings, Gillespie put aside his affable stage personality and played with fire. By comparison, when Gillespie operated his own record label, DG, for a time in the early 1950s, the results were uneven. Solid jazz records were interspersed with clumsy offerings such as Swing Low, Sweet Cadillac, Umbrella Man, and School Days. With Granz, however, Gillespie needed to show up at the studio ready for battle. In his 1957 recording of I Know That You Know, Dizzy must follow a scintillating Sonny Rollins stop-time solo and obliges with a tour-de-force effort. A 1956 session finds the trumpeter in the middle of a heated saxophone duet between Stan Getz and Sonny Stitt. In song after song, each taken at a furious tempo, Gillespie feeds off the energy of the two combatants. Another successful project from the period matches Gillespie with his earlier role model, Roy Eldridge. Granz, with his passion for the jam session, instinctively understood that Dizzy was at his best when an element of one-upmanship permeated the musical proceedings. When compared against such spirited outings, Parker's string orchestra efforts, supervised by Granz, are a mixed achievement at best. Certainly the blame here is not solely Granz's. Parker had long been fascinated with contemporary orchestral music. His conversations were laced with references to Prokofiev and Stravinsky. He told a Swedish interviewer that violinist Jascha Heifetz ranked among his favorite musicians. His phrasing is such that he swings. At his daughter's funeral, he had a pianist play the music of Bartok. As noted, he discussed taking lessons with modernist composer Edgar Varèse, reportedly offering to cook for Varèse in return, and supposedly sent a letter to Arnold Schoenberg asking for advice. Given these leanings, orchestral settings were an obvious area of exploration for Parker. Yet Byrd lacked the patience to oversee the details of such ambitious projects. Unlike an Ellington, for whom composition, arranging, and band leading were areas of passionate interest, Parker was inclined to delegate these tasks to others and merely show up to play. For the string orchestra projects, arrangements were contracted out, with mediocre results. rather than Prokofiev or Bartok, the models these charts mostly call to mind are rather the worst examples of Paul Whiteman's concert jazz from the 1920s and 1930s. Alas, they would have been better suited as accompaniment, not to the leading altoist in modern jazz, but at most to an elevator journey of brief duration. Clearly, there was a degree of credibility that Parker earned by fronting a string orchestra, an aura of respectability that few jazz artists enjoyed during these years and most craved. Yet, in the final analysis, Bird with Strings, as these efforts came to be known, never came close to realizing Parker's aspirations for creating modern